It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 92 for Friday, the 7th of September, 2012. This week, we're going to be joined by Chris Wolstenholm from the band Muse to discuss, amongst other things, music and technology. Plus, can a type of thermal imaging be used to find drunks loitering in public spaces? Also on the show,
NASA are looking at implanting synthetic life forms under the skin of astronauts.
That was geneticist Adam Rutherford talking about the incredible field of synthetic biology, which we will be exploring later in the show with his help, along with the wider field of transhumanism. It's a lot of stuff, and it's all coming up with knobs on this week's show. Hoi hoi, Nate Langson here. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, of course, associate editor Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
Hi, and junior staff writer Ian Steadman.
Hey, hey.
Hey, as opposed to any other Steadman, in your stead. I'm back from Berlin. I'm back like the Renegade Master.
I was thinking like the Backstreet Boys.
No, I've never been like those. Even when I was in my Spice Girls cover group, The Herb Boys. This is tangential and irrelevant. We're going to be talking to Muse on the show today, and we're actually going to get straight into that first. And then after that, we have got a whole host of news stories to get into. Hey there, Chris. Nate Langston here from Wired. How are you doing?
I'm great, thanks.
Fantastic. Well, thanks ever so much for joining us on the show today. Very big fans of Muse at Wired. So first, I actually want to talk about your new album. So the title, The Second Law, I have to find out, is that of thermodynamics or of robotics?
Thermodynamics. Obviously, the second law of thermodynamics talks about, you know, within isolated energy systems, how energy cannot transfer from one thing to another without some form of loss. And how, you know, human life itself is almost a conflict against all of that. And, you know, I think there's many things that are happening. Now, obviously, you can relate that to the financial crisis, which I think is probably the most current example of, you know, something that's happening that you can relate that theory to. But you can also relate it to your body. You can relate it to the planet. You know, it's very, very open. And I think it's something that we realize that is just coming up a lot in the lyrics, you know. The way, you know, we're obsessed with growth, we're obsessed with, you know, becoming richer and, you know, this endless kind of expanse of growth that just quite simply isn't sustainable and will eventually just create chaos, I guess, you know.
Yeah, so this is a very strong theme by the sounds of it throughout the entire album.
I wouldn't say it was through the entire album. I mean, I think there's references to it. I think a lot of the stuff on the album comes from a much more personal place, but I think that, You know, even relationships, I think, can relate to the second law. You know, I think Madness is very much about that, the single. You know, it talks about the kind of, it's a twisted love story, but also talks about the kind of chaos and how the sort of energy of love itself kind of creates this chaos and this kind of disorder that you have to somehow manage, you know.
Mm. Now, I mean, you guys have always incorporated huge amounts of science in your lyrics and themes. And I read last year, actually, that you guys wanted to be the first band to play in space. Now, is that still the plan?
Well, yeah, I mean, we'd love to. I mean, it's something that we've talked about, you know, for a long time. And I think, obviously, as time goes on, I think the possibilities of that are obviously getting closer. You know, whether it will happen or not is another thing. I know it's something we've expressed an interest in. And, you know, also whether it's realistic, I'm not sure whether gravity would allow you to, or the lack of gravity would allow you to play the guitar very well. But I think there would be some form of gig that would probably involve, you know, an acoustic guitar and a bongo that would probably work, you know.
Awesome. I know that Will.i.am had a song, I think, play from NASA's Curiosity on Mars the other week.
So, right.
getting pretty close. So you mentioned Madness, the single off the album earlier, and I was actually watching the video for that this morning, and you seem to be playing some kind of giant glowing touchscreen device embedded in your bass guitar that has no strings. I have to find out, what is that thing?
Well, it's called a Kitara. And obviously, on the album, it was a synth part, but we wanted to try and work out a way that we could use a synth but play it like a guitar, you know. And to be honest, it's something that we've been looking at for a long time, but we've always had these kind of issues with as soon as you have something with a touchpad device and you're running through a computer into a synth, you get all these kind of latency issues, and it takes a while to process the sound. So we finally found this thing which actually allows you to play it, and you can play it like a guitar because it has buttons where you would have the frets, and all the buttons represent the six strings and all the frets on the guitar. So you can, if you can play a guitar, you can play the thing, but rather than pluck strings, you touch the screen, and the screen, you can control various different parameters with the screen. So we gave it a go, and I've actually had a custom-made one built now, which has the guitar sat on top of a real bass, so it's like a double-neck thing, which I'll have to use to play Madness live, which looks pretty crazy, actually.
I was going to ask, is that something you then people are going to be able to see on the tour?
Yeah, I actually only got it yesterday. It turned up at rehearsal, because up until this point, I've been playing the song with two basses around my neck. Obviously, the real bass and the guitar, which was an obscene amount of weight and completely enough to be knackered my shoulder. But luckily, the thing turned up yesterday, the actual real thing, which is like, you know, obviously one big body with two necks sticking out of it, and that's what I'll play on live.
I think Matt had one, didn't he, for playing a solo. I think it was like a Korg Chaos Pad in a guitar.
Yeah, he's got a couple of guitars where he's got the Chaos Pad built in, and he's also got the Keytar as well, which he had custom made, which he used for Undisclosed Desires, I think, where you can, it's kind of like two different MIDI controllers. You've got the keyboard where you would normally pluck the strings, but then you've also got a whole bunch of separate MIDI notes that you can control from your left hand as well. So he's always liked delving into the sort of technology side of, you know, trying to push guitars into a new era, I think.
Yeah. I mean, what's quite funny about that is that, I mean, the Korg Chaos Pad is basically a consumer device. You know, people can just go out and buy one. I mean, has consumer technology affected how you guys write and record as well as play?
Well, I think it's so much easier to document ideas now, you know, and that's where I think it really comes into play for us. I mean, you know, years ago, if you wanted to, you know, if you just had an idea for a song, you had to rely on maybe carrying a big clunky four-track machine around with you or something, or an eight-track, which just wasn't really realistic when you're touring, you know. Yeah. And I think obviously now with iPads and I guess specifically laptops, you know, you can get a very sort of compact Pro Tools version on your laptop with an M-Box where you can plug a guitar into or a microphone, and you can very easily kind of record things on the fly. So I think from an ideas point of view, it's great because you could just document everything very easily. And I think obviously now with the iPad, you know, it's I don't think it's quite there yet, but it's getting there, where, you know, things like the, you know, the Line 6 amp modelers and things like that. So you've always got a guitar amp basically in your bag, and you know, all those sort of things are great for, you know, there's a lot of downtime when you're on tour, and obviously it's, you know, sometimes it's nice to do something productive with that time and try and get creative, and it's so easy to carry the tools around to do that now.
Yeah. So what kind of phones and tablets do you guys carry around with you?
I think we're all pretty appled up, actually. I think we're all on Macs, we're all on iPads, and all on iPhones, I think. But I just love the whole iCloud thing. You know, it's amazing having your entire, I think I've probably got the largest collection of iTunes MP3s in the world. So it's kind of great being able to access that from anywhere in the world without having to travel around with a big hard drive with all your films and music on. You know, it's just all there. You can download it wherever you are. You know, it's brilliant.
Well, Chris, thanks ever so much for taking the time out to talk to us. Can't wait for the new album next month. And I think actually we're going to be seeing you at the iTunes Festival gig at the 30th of this month, actually, at the, I think, the Roundhouse.
Oh, excellent.
So we're
all looking forward to that. I mean, we've got, I think, our first gigs in a couple of weeks in Germany. So, and I think that's maybe the third or fourth gig.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for joining us on the podcast, mate, and good luck with the album.
Excellent. Thanks, mate.
Thank you, Chris. It's quite nice to have another sort of musician on the show. We haven't had anyone since Moby, I think.
I thought you were saying another as in you and Chris. Like, it's great to have another.
Well, I do play the drums. You can search for Nate Langston on iTunes. You'll find my downloads. I'm not actually kidding. You can. Let's get into the news then, shall we? The first is, and this is going to be very, very quick, the iPhone 5 is going to be announced on the 12th of September. Apple has invited people to an event, myself included, by extension, all of Wired, to the event, which is taking place in the US. There is a mirror event going on in London on the evening of the 12th, and we're expecting the iPhone Funf. Sorry, I'm still on Berlin mode. Bigger screen, more power, iOS 6, various other things.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's about all we've got to say about that.
That's pretty much all we're going to say on the matter for this week. Check back next week. Obviously, we'll have a report. The most interesting non-iPhone-related news on our list.
Apart from news.
Is,
and transhumanism.
and the other news items. Is an algorithm thermal imaging system that can scan for drunks live.
Yes.
What's the H?
Well, this is a team of computer scientists from the University of Patras in Greece. And they've built a couple of different algorithms that can be used in conjunction with thermal imaging to tell if someone is drunk or not in public places.
This is a real problem, though. I mean, I can spot a drunk.
Well,
I'm looking at Ian right now.
It's not something that this is the police or anyone has expressed an absolute need for. But they do say that apparently there's the very embarrassing situation for some policemen of approaching people who they see to be drunk or like they make assumptions based on their behaviour and their appearance that they're drunk when actually they're not. And so this would be a way of telling if someone was drunk or not. But in another way that could be equally awkward, I feel.
Without a breathalyzer.
Because if they can cope with it, like tolerate lots of alcohol, and then you're just approaching them when they haven't done anything, it seems like a massive breach of privacy. But anyway.
The system
works by having two algorithms, one of which focuses on the amount of like heat in someone's face. So when you drink alcohol, the veins in your, the blood vessels in your face dilate, and this brings kind of heat to your face. And you might have experienced that if anyone here has drunk alcohol before. And so that algorithm will compare the face and the kind of thermal imaging of that face to a load of data, a database of loads of faces, some drunk, some not drunk, to kind of work out what the kind of patterns of heat are on their faces. And then the second area looks at the different, second algorithm looks at the different areas where the heat is focused. Apparently, drunk people tend to have a lot of redness, a lot of heat in the nose areas.
do you mean the nose? They have hot noses.
They have hot noses. I guess you get that old gouty old men with bulbous noses and women. and apparently the forehead is relatively quite cool. So that is how the two algorithms work. But yeah, I don't think this is something, I think this is something that's going to be fairly difficult to put into practice. I know that they used thermal imaging to see whether the Occupy protesters were in their tents outside St. Paul's and people were up in arms, because there's something very worrying about the fact that you can kind of see through walls, basically.
Yeah, it would be quite interesting as well to have this installed in a bar. You know, a lot of bars will refuse to serve you if you appear intoxicated. You could have a camera to see whether you are eligible for more alcohol.
Yeah.
But it would hurt business, though, so would they actually want it?
Well, we've had this test, actually, about the breathalyzer system that you can install. It's like, you know, 20p a breathalyze. The little system on about a year ago, we talked about that. But anyway, this sounds really interesting. I have a mental image of sort of policemen standing in a riot scene holding a speed camera-like device, sort of scanning people they think are drunk but can't tell.
But being drunk's not a crime. Being drunk and disorderly is a crime. So it seems like it's a bit kind of pre-crimey and terrifying. But I think it's interesting technology.
Mm. Liv, if I insult a spider, apparently it helps my fear of them.
Well, it's not really insulting a spider. It's not saying, hey, mate, you know, you're a bit of a knob. It's more acknowledging verbally your fear of the spider can help you dissipate that fear. Or help that fear to dissipate.
Yeah, I just had the drunk man standing next to a bath saying, I've got to do this, and just hurling abuse at an arachnid.
Yeah.
And spider's like, dude, making a web.
So regular models of kind of combating phobias tend to involve like exposure therapy. The idea of like the more you see spiders, the more you get used to them, you can kind of tolerate them more, and then you might be able to touch them and you kind of get closer and closer. Other methods are kind of, you know, talking about how the spider's much smaller than you and, you know, you're big and it's much more scared of you, blah, blah, blah. But these psychologists at UCLA decided to kind of turn this on its head. And what they did was that they devised an experiment to test whether expressing like how terrified you are of the spider made any difference to your fear of the spider. And so they divided 88 different arachnophobes into four groups, and they were all asked to try and approach a tarantula and see if they could touch it.
Wow.
Which is terrifying. And so they all went into a room with a tarantula and they saw how close they could get to it, and all along the psychologists were measuring physiological signs of fear, things like their heart rate and their sweaty palms. Mm-hmm. And one group was told to verbalize their fear of the spiders, you know, tell them, you're terrifying, you're creepy as hell, I hate you. Another group was told to do some of the more traditional techniques of saying, you're smaller than me, I'm stronger than you, I can beat you. One group was told to say something irrelevant, I like bananas, for example, and another group said nothing at all. And a week later, they were asked to do the tarantula test again. And it turned out that the first group, the ones who'd verbalised their fear and the ones who'd verbalised it in the most emotive way, were the ones that actually could get closer to the tarantula the second time.
So it's very counterintuitive.
Really counterintuitive. And psychologists don't really understand it either, because they were only verbalising things that they already knew. So it wasn't really conditioning their thoughts in any different way. Mm. So they obviously need to do further studies. But it's absolutely fascinating that they found that the actual verbal expression of their negative feelings helped them be less scared the second time round.
But, I wonder how this would work with fears that aren't tangible, like a spider. I mean, you could argue about being on a plane, and a plane's still tangible, but some kind of really irrational fear, like how would an agoraphobic, for example, would they open the window and shout, I'm afraid of the outdoors?
That's a very good question.
Because at least when you're focusing on a spider, I don't know, I guess you're associating that.
And you can focus on the spider.
I mean, yeah.
How do you focus on the outdoors?
It's
everywhere.
Yes. It's a really interesting study, and I do hope that we see tests for this in sort of other, less tangible categories of fear, if you like.
Yeah, I think we just need to kind of knock this arachnophobia on the head. We don't need to be nice to spiders. We can keep our fear and kill them all.
I was trying to think of a segue to something to do with money, but I'm failing.
Money spiders.
Money spiders.
Very good.
They're the only spiders I can actually hold, the tiny weenie ones.
Okay, well, on the topic of money spiders, money.
Money.
Ian, Bitcoin has been in a lot of trouble this week
thanks to a heist. A heist, indeed. Well, I mean, it brings to mind images of people in balaclavas.
First we had the maple syrup heist, now we have the Bitcoin heist.
There is nothing safe from in this terrible crime wave. This is the heist at Bitfloor, which is apparently the UK's biggest trading exchange for bitcoins.
Mm-hmm. Bitcoins being the virtual currency
that are kind of decentralized
untraceable.
And untraceable, and very popular people who like to buy things like drugs and guns and apparently assassins online.
Which I'm sure we'll come to shortly.
Yes. But this is Bitfloor, who it's just an exchange where people, like in real life, can buy and sell bitcoins for other currency and vice versa. And they hold a certain amount of bitcoins and other currency to make sure that they can cover any losses from the transaction. They had about 30,000 bitcoins, apparently, of which 24,000 were stolen by a hacker. And it was stolen because the founder of the site, a guy called Roman Stillman, had done a backup of the site and had left an unencrypted key or password on a server which was connected to the web. So a hacker was just, I guess, snooping around, found out this thing was unencrypted, just snuck in and nicked all the bitcoins.
Let's put this in the context of real hard cash.
Yes.
How much is 24,000 bitcoins worth?
About £160,000.
So somebody stole £160,000 worth of other people's
virtual
money. Yes.
Money. That seems like quite a significant theft.
It is quite significant.
Via
theft.
A quite significant fail on the part of Roman.
Yes. He admitted it himself. I think he said that when someone pulled him up and asked him, you realise this is an extremely dumb way to run a website, he said, yes, I realise this is a very serious mistake.
It really is. It's not regulated in the same way that other exchanges would be regulated.
I mean,
whole point, I guess. But
let's make an analogy here, though, just quickly, before we move into the next part of the story, which is that this would be very similar to, say, a bank storing all of its users' passwords in like a text file just on a server.
Yeah.
And if
exactly.
someone could access that text file, they could access the user's account.
Exactly.
And they could wipe their bank accounts clean. That's basically what's happened here with this virtual currency.
Yeah.
And the problem is that there's no guarantees with Bitcoins. That's kind of half the point.
That's
there's
the
no
point.
Underwritten.
I mean,
and no way of tracing them.
Yeah, the people who use Bitcoin a lot love the fact that it hasn't got those guarantees, because a lot of them are people like libertarians who don't think that you should have some central body in charge of money.
But these people are screwed now.
Yeah, they are screwed. And that means that a lot of people are pointing and laughing at the people who use Bitcoins and saying you should have thought of that before you got involved.
Mm.
Roman Stillman, the guy who owns the site, is basically kind of posted a plea for help on the forum for Bitfloor, saying, please don't all ask for your money back now that we've had this hack.
So it's kind of like the Wall Street crash.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. He doesn't want to have a bank run because he knows that if everyone asked for their money back, he just couldn't cover it.
It's like
it.
When Northern Rock said, don't worry, don't come and get your money out. And
which is the
queues,
worst thing to do.
The queues went around the corner.
So I'll only take 4 bitcoins because I just need to buy my crack.
Yes.
That sort of situation.
He does say that the hackers didn't get any of the US dollars they have, and he has a few $100,000 US dollars safe, but I mean that's not enough to cover the cost of the bitcoins that were lost.
No.
And he also knows how much each person lost. Basically, he's got those records. Problem is, he can't cover them. So he's asking for help, basically.
But this isn't the first time we've had this sort of problem with exchanges, is it? There was one a little while ago that was not dissimilar.
Yeah, there was another British site called Mt. Gox, which is a very popular exchange site. And some hackers used, they had a currency exchange on their site, and the hackers basically drove the conversion rate down so that it was 1 US cent per Bitcoin. Then bought something like 2,000 or 3,000 bitcoins at that price before anyone noticed. Mm. And there was no way of tracing them after it happened, and they got away with it, and they ended up with sort of 10 times that much. There's also, there was a massive pyramid scheme in America last month called Bitcoin Savings and Trust, which claimed to be a hedge fund, a virtual hedge fund. But the owner disappeared with $5.6 million worth of bitcoins last month. Out of nowhere.
Bitcoin generally is a bit of a pyramid scheme, isn't it? Because it relies on people using their computers to generate more currency, and then the demand for that currency to drive up the price of the currency.
Yeah.
And it feels like, you know, that bottom of that can fall out quite easily. And I think they have had huge amounts of fluctuations in the value of the currency.
Oh, huge fluctuations. I mean, there is a limit eventually on how many Bitcoins
21 million.
Be. Yes.
Mm. Yeah. But, and they reckon once it gets to that, then there'll be a finite amount and they'll...
Yeah, and it'll kind of stabilize a bit.
But it's all run by an algorithm. It's a Japanese invention,
his name
really.
Is Japanese. No one knows who he is.
But he's run off.
Well, yeah, that's the creepy thing about him is that he's this programmer who used... his name was Satoshi Nakamoto.
Okay.
That was just the programmer's pseudonym that he used on some forum. He wrote the original program to generate bitcoins and the algorithm that enabled transactions, released it into the wild, then disappeared, and no one knows who he is or where he came from, or even
or
if he was
much
Japanese.
How money he's making?
I saw a theory that said he was British because all his posts on the main Bitcoin forum were at GMT times, so it would have been like afternoon time for us rather than Japan.
I see. Yeah. Interesting. Mm. Well, the plot and story behind Bitcoin thickens like a soup. And
left a bit too long.
We'll take another sip from this hot broth in the coming months, I'm sure, and hopefully it will not be out of date
or too hot.
I don't know how long I can continue this for. I stop now?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's transition into a break, and when we come back, we're going to start talking about the wonderful world of transhumanism.
Wired's second annual summit is coming. Following a sellout debut in 2011, Wired 2012 will feature an incredible lineup of speakers and thought-provoking talks over 2 days in London. The first names have already been announced, so find out more at wiredevent.co.uk.
Liv, we have been doing a package of content on wired.co.uk this week about transhumanism, synthetic biology, and various other related fields of science and biology.
Yes.
It has fascinated me.
Yeah, well, it was all triggered by the fact that it's the Paralympics. And during the Paralympics, we've seen some amazing examples of how kind of science and technology can be used to overcome human limitations. So we've seen the running blades, we've seen some prosthetics. Like one of my favourite examples is this incredible cyclist, a Canadian guy called Jay Milley. And he is classified as a quadruple amputee. And his bike, his bike has been highly, highly modified. He has two prosthetic legs that clip into the cleats on his, that have cleats to clip into the pedals. So he doesn't obviously need to have shoes and feet. Mm-hmm. And then he has a prosthetic arm, and he has the other arm he has half a hand on his other arm, so he doesn't have the strength to pull the brakes. And so they've developed a bum brake for him. He shifts his weight back on his seat, and that's how he brakes his bike, which is fantastic. Mm. So most of the technology on show in the Paralympics is seen as therapeutic, i.e. replacing something that's missing or, you know, making someone quote unquote normal. Mm-hmm. So it's replacing a limb or, you know, having some replacement arm, et cetera, et cetera. So transhumanism is a kind of emerging movement that explores using science and technology to enhance the human body or mind, regardless of whether you have any perceived disabilities or not. So this is where it starts getting really interesting. You know, on one hand, it's about lengthening life, and things like cryonics fall under transhumanism. In other cases, it's just about little biohacking, creating kind of, I don't know, tattoos that maybe light up to show when your blood sugar levels have changed, or putting magnets under your finger.
But there's been a number of things aside from that, though. Things like, brain control prosthetics, which is where you sort of neural implants can be implanted. In fact, a good example was there was a guy, I mean, he was hailed as sort of being the world's first bionic man.
Yeah.
And this was a man who lost both of his arms in an electrical accident. He was an electrical engineer working on really high powered electrical lines. He lost both of his arms as a result of an accident there. And what he was able to do, he was given two robotic arms that were strapped to him with like a harness, and doctors took nerves out of his arm and effectively linked them up to muscles in his chest. And then there was a sensor in this harness that he was wearing that detected contractions in the muscle, and then the a computer in this harness detected those contractions and interpreted them as the intention to move a hand, or to twist a hand, or to lift up an arm. And it enabled him to, you know, actually lift coffee cups to his mouth and control this arm literally by thinking about picking up a coffee cup.
Yeah.
Because the connection from the brain to the nerves was undamaged, and then the nerves were connected to muscles, machine.
Exactly.
And he's not the first to have done that. Well, he was the first to have this done, but he's not been the only one to have this done. And we're seeing a number of other innovations on those lines.
Yeah, so that's absolutely fascinating. But, you know, you might see that as, is that just replacing a missing arm? But actually, that is serious frontiers of technology right there.
Yeah.
So there's some very kind of outlandish ideas, like, would you replace a healthy eye with a bionic one if you got additional kind of capabilities?
I mean, there is the case when people have the choice of having something like just a regular prosthetic eye if they do lose their eye or lose vision, or putting something, let's be honest, more useful in there than a prosthetic eye. I mean, we met the guy Rob Spence, and he was a guy who did lose an eye as a result of an accident with a gun when he was a teenager, and he replaced it with a video camera. And it was a video camera embedded in a prosthetic eyeball that was in his head. It had a radio transmitter in it, and so he could show on a screen what he was seeing. And he's actually been in the office before. I can't remember why actually now, but he's been in, and it is kind of incredible.
One of the guys that Liat spoke to was talking about how he wanted to get rid of the need to have sleep because he found it a real hassle and a waste of time. But also he was looking at the really, really far future stuff, like once we've achieved singularity, assuming that we do, he was talking about the idea of being able to 3D print whatever body that you wanted, download your consciousness into it, no biggie, and then float around in that shape for that time, for however long you wanted, and then change at a later date.
So effective immortality.
Effective immortality. Well, that is kind of what the singularity is all about, isn't it?
I think it raises interesting questions in terms of how this could be funded. You know, I mean, if you think about today, could you get such procedures performed on the NHS, for example? The answer is an undoubted no.
No.
But in the future...
Yeah, that's one of the really interesting issues, is what healthcare services should be provided. You know, in certain cases at the moment, you can get cosmetic surgery on the NHS if you're sufficiently upset about it. What happens if most people have the money and the ability to afford to get private treatment to get, I don't know, their eyes improved so that they can have night vision? And everyone has night vision apart from, you know, 30% of people don't have night vision. And so then not having night vision becomes the kind of disability. And so as these things evolve, the NHS will have to evolve with them as the kind of things become the norm, and the modifications that we can make become, you know, different things become possible. The NHS is going to have to adapt in order to be able to cater for these things when they go right, and also cater for them when they go wrong. And that's the other big kind of issue of when you're meddling around with the body like this.
But we've been speaking mostly at this point on hardware improvements and physical attachments, let's say, to the body. I think what's more interesting, and perhaps slightly closer to our hearts, literally and figuratively, are medications.
Drugs.
And drugs. Because this is another really interesting area of transhumanism. mechanism, I guess.
Yes.
That a lot of research is taking place in. It's a really fascinating area.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the transhumanist stuff is very theoretical, but the kind of chemical enhancement is stuff, there's a lot of developments going on that are actually kind of happening now, and they might not be available for us to take, but they are taking place. So there are a number of different areas that you might want to be enhanced chemically. And, you know, we're familiar with steroids and ADHD medication, but there are a lot of researchers working on memory enhancement. Now, the research is taking place because of Alzheimer's disease. However, if you can develop a drug that can fix, well, not fix, but ease the symptoms of Alzheimer's, you can actually help people who don't have Alzheimer's have a much more an enhanced memory. So Baylor University researchers have developed a molecule, they've discovered a molecule called PKR, which regulates the memory. But when this is suppressed, your body creates a much better molecule that makes memory much, much more effective. And obviously, if they can work out how to suppress the first molecule, they can generate the second molecule.
So it's a little bit like a more talented understudy stepping in.
Exactly.
Because you've locked the original actor in a cage.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a very strange situation that this is even the case. So they're trying to work on finding a suppressant, a chemical suppressant, for PKR that could then, you know, generate this effect, which is fascinating.
Well, there's another researcher actually called Cynthia Kenyon, who's done a load of work with nematode worms, and by sort of suppressing this gene called DAF2, she was able to make the worms live 6 times longer.
Yeah.
Which is amazing, because she believes that the gene may actually play a really key role in human aging and actually could be manipulated with drugs.
Yeah, obviously there's a big difference between nematode worms and humans, but I think she really thinks that this is a possibility.
I think it's fantastic if you could.
And she's talking about 15 years.
Hmm.
That's like that guy saying that the first person to live to 1,000 years old is already alive.
Yeah.
Walking around, maybe even as old as 40 or 50 years old.
That actually came up at a conference I was at last night, which we'll talk
again
about actually in a bit. Yeah. So what about stuff like moral enhancements? I mean, this is another topic that we've approached in this series.
Yeah.
That is another interesting area.
This is something, again, that there's a lot of discussion about from transhumanists. It's pretty controversial, though, because it discusses the idea of using chemicals to have an effect on people's moral behavior. And the language of this is very, very complex, and I don't think we can really simplify it that easily. But there are already drugs that have an effect already on kind of perceived moral behavior.
Well, so, like antidepressants or something.
Yeah. So an antidepressant might make someone more aggressive, less aggressive, yeah, rather than more aggressive. And there's things like oxytocin that increase feelings of empathy, which people have kind of misguidedly called the moral molecule, as if it's like the, you know, single factor in all our moral behavior. But the idea is that if you could really understand the brain, our brain chemistry, which we don't at the moment, you could then know the exact kind of quantities of chemicals that you could synthesize in order to create the emotional responses in people that could then trigger the, you know, different behavior. But there's a lot of ifs there. You know, just because someone feels a different way emotionally doesn't mean they're going to behave a certain way. It also presupposes that we know what right and wrong moral behavior is.
That kind of it worries me more than any of the other stuff so far, because it kind of affects what we perceive as free will, I think.
I mean, exactly. And so there's a lot of criticism in the transhumanist community that this is about control of people rather than about, you know, making them more moral. It's a kind of drugging them. Well, it is exactly that. Yeah. It's drugging them. And is it the kind of lobotomy of the late 21st century?
Yeah, well, I mean, this comes very close to the idea of being able to create synthetic bacteria that in itself is able to more efficiently target bad bacteria or disease in the body. And this area of synthetic biology is actually something that came up at a conference I was at just last night, and this is total coincidence. But the geneticist Adam Rutherford said that the second industrial revolution has begun, and it's in the field of synthetic biology. And he really does believe that. And we recorded a clip actually of him speaking at this conference last night that had a lot of significance, and let's play the clip.
And what it is that we've got to the stage of our control in terms of how genetics and DNA works, that we're capable of constructing organisms, mostly bacteria, that serve us in order to act as manufacturers. And it's my contention that the second major industrial revolution has begun, and it is the synthetic biology industrial revolution, and that there will be almost no aspect of life which is not affected in the next 40 years, the next 100 years, the next few centuries, by our ability to create machines and products using living things rather than inanimate things. This is a nascent field. The high water marks are few and far between at the moment. One of them is in the production of a chemical called artemisinin. Now, artemisinin is the most effective treatment for malaria, and unfortunately, it grows in a tree, a plant, rather unreliably. It's very expensive to harvest. And synthetic biologists in California have come up with a yeast which produces this stuff at a rate which will reduce the cost of artemisinin production by about 100-fold. Now, that's incredibly effective. Last year, there was the first design of a biological circuit which was capable of A, identifying a specific type of cancer cell, and then B, inducing suicide in only those cells. So if you think about the blunderbuss approach of chemotherapy and radiotherapy, where basically you're killing as many cells as possible in order to hit that tumor, what this synthetic circuit does is effectively act as a sniper. So it identifies using a Boolean logic, a computational logic, the particular type of cancer cells, and then kills them. We already have bacteria that are capable of digesting environmental oil spills or sequestering heavy metals. NASA are looking at implanting synthetic life forms under the skin of astronauts in order to provide an in situ remedy for radiation poisoning when they're traveling in space, radiation sickness being the most difficult challenge in space exploration.
That was Adam Rutherford talking at the Royal Society, actually, last night with Professor Stephen Hawking, which I have to say, it's not very often you get to say you've been at a conference with Stephen Hawking, but that's where I was last night. And that was, he's got a new documentary coming out on the Discovery Channel called Grand Design on the 13th of September. And that's why we were there. But I think what Adam was saying is kind of wraps up everything we've been talking about in a sense, because it really encompasses just how big a deal all this stuff is set to be in the future, if not necessarily right now. Well, we've got loads more stories on the site on this topic. If you go to wired.co.uk/transhuman, you will find our content hub called Transhuman Week. We've got everything there, from transhumanism to synthetic biology and all the moral questions therein. Let us know what you think, podcast@wired.co.uk, which transitions us very nicely to the end of the show, doesn't it, Liv?
It does.
And how do people get in touch with us if they want to tell us what they think? What body parts would they want to upgrade in the future?
Yeah, well, we already had a few people telling us on Twitter, but in case you missed it, you can tweet us. We're on @WiredUK. We've also got a fantastic Facebook page. It's facebook.com/WiredUK. And we also use that old school technology called email, podcast@wired.co.uk.
It is. And I think on that note, I'm going to go and read something really vacuous to sort of calm my brain down from the last number of minutes of talking about.
We can talk about clementines again.
No, we did enough of that before the show started. See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
It's a really tangy clementine.
It's lovely, isn't it?
It's really nice, but it's making my lips vibrate and my tongue dance.
What are you actually about to get? Are you having an allergic reaction? Anaphylactic shock?
No, I've just never eaten a clementine this juicy and this
You've never eaten
succulent.
A proper clementine then?